Hello, my name is Whitney Schneidman, and I chair the Africa practice at Covington and Burling. I hope you, your families, and your colleagues are safe and healthy. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our briefing on how cybersecurity considerations may be impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. It is my pleasure to introduce two of my colleagues who are immensely experienced on issues related to cybersecurity. Michael Chertoff, who is Senior of Counsel at Covington, was the second United States Secretary of Homeland Security, where he spearheaded a national cybersecurity policy. Secretary Chertoff was the co-author of the Patriot Act and has served on the National Security Council, the Homeland Security Council, and the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Leading today's discussion is Robert Kayahura, who is of counsel at Covington and resident in our Johannesburg office. Bob is a vice chair of the Africa practice and is very active in the firm's innovative global problem solving, public policy, and technology practice groups. Before coming to Covington, Bob worked for several leading global technology firms and is now working with a number of tech multinationals and tech and startups across the continent. So let me now turn to Bob, who will lead today's discussion with Secretary Chertoff. Bob, over to you.
Thank you very much for that, Whitney. Much appreciated. Secretary Chertoff, it's a pleasure to be able to follow up on the discussion we had about cybersecurity issues during your visit to South Africa a few months ago. And I look forward to continuing that discussion about general cybersecurity best practices, particularly in context of this COVID-19 pandemic, as well as general law and policy issues that we'll continue to grapple with long after this pandemic has passed. First and foremost, again, thank you very much for taking the time to have this important discussion. So I thought I would start with a fairly basic, but I think critical question to help set some context. The term cybersecurity means so many different things. Whether you're talking to individuals or tech and IT specialists in a corporate setting, or certainly in my case, talking to policymakers looking at cybersecurity issues from a national security perspective, you get different answers, and there's no real sort of coherent definition of what cybersecurity means. Considering your exceptional background, which Whitney just shared with us, deep experience as a government lawyer, you've been in private sector for a while, you've served as a federal court judge, obviously as the former Secretary of Homeland Security, where you helped develop the cyber strategy for the United States. How does somebody with your breadth of experience and insight define cybersecurity, and what do you consider the component parts?
Well, first of all, thank you for hosting this. I think this is a particularly significant time to be having this discussion, given what's going on globally with the pandemic. So let me begin by saying, generally, when we talk about cybersecurity, we're talking about four things. Maintaining the confidentiality of communications that are online, or data that's being stored that's accessible online. And that has to do with making sure nobody steals your data, doesn't intercept your private conversations, or otherwise reveal things that you would like to keep secret. The second related concept is availability. You want the availability of the internet and the ability to have cyber communication whenever you want it. So if someone, for example, interferes with your ability to log on, where they overwhelm your server with a denial of service attack, that affects the availability of your internet connection. We've seen cases in the past, for example, where financial institutions got cut off in terms of access remotely, and that meant people couldn't get their money. And so that's an availability issue. As we escalate up the problem chain, the next issue we consider part of cybersecurity is the integrity of the data. This is the question not of whether someone is stealing your data or making it unreachable, but whether they are actually changing it in order to alter it in a way that corrupts its validity or accuracy. This is more serious because it could affect, for example, records of the amount of money you have in a bank account or your health records. And so this is maybe one of the highest levels of concern we address from a cybersecurity standpoint. And finally, there's the issue of industrial control systems. More and more of what we do in the real physical world, running our power plants, our water plants, our transportation systems, are dependent upon the internet to have them controlled. And so if someone interferes with that, the effect is not only to make the internet perhaps inaccessible, but it may actually have ramifications for the physical world. Your power gets cut off, your transportation gets cut off, and that could result in loss of life and very, very serious economic damage. So those are the four kinds of threats we worry about when we talk about cybersecurity and cybersecurity threats.
That's very helpful. And I think that last one in particular gives us a perfect segue to, you know, what's playing out in sort of the global scene today. And with that definition in mind, and certainly turning again to this public health crisis that's turned all our lives upside down, what are you seeing with respect to, you know, the reported increase in cyber attacks during the global pandemic? And furthermore, it'd be great to get your perspective on why would the risks be greater now than they are on any other day, where it seems we're just constantly inundated with these attacks and threats?
Well, there has been reporting of an increase in threats and an increase in attacks, some of them directed at healthcare systems, where ransomware is being used to extort money from hospitals or health systems by locking down and encrypting the data and then telling the network operator, if you don't pay us money, we're going to basically never let you get your data back. And at a time when people were very worried about monitoring health, that's obviously a very, very serious threat. The other challenge is this. More and more work is being done from home. The amount of telework being done online as opposed to people going into the office or the power plant has dramatically increased. What that means is there are many, many more people who are online at any given point in time and who present targets for attack. Moreover, many of these people, when they work from home, are using endpoints, personal computers, telephones, things of that sort, that are not particularly secure. They're not at their workplace where you have certain minimal security elements in place. And so therefore, there's a weak spot in the whole network where people are working in very unsecure and unpatched devices. So that creates greater vulnerabilities along with the greater temptation to exploit this for criminal purposes. And so I think what we're seeing now is an enormous amount of stress on the system. And even apart from nefarious activity, one of the challenges is the infrastructure, which has been built for one scale of usage, is now being subjected to twice or three times as much traffic. And that again creates a stress on the system. So this is a moment where it's particularly vulnerable to bad actors taking advantage and either stealing money or stealing data or simply trying to wreak havoc on our networks.
That's interesting. And particularly on that last point with respect to the stress on the global system, because you're absolutely right. I mean, the number of people working remotely worldwide would definitely challenge that infrastructure, but we seem to be faring quite well on that front. Is it a fair observation? Or are you seeing anything that leads to concern on general infrastructure side?
I'm seeing that there's stress on the system. Think the latency or the slowness has increased. Certain sites seem to drop from time to time. So I do think we're seeing, you know, varied reactions to the amount of stress on the system. And particularly when you go to those areas in the world where you don't have a lot of bandwidth, and the most advanced, you know, 5G systems, again, it means everything is slower. The amount of data that moves is constraining the system. I think there was a report that Netflix in Europe was forced to turn down some of its activity because the volume of data that they needed to move was putting too much stress on the system.
Yes, and there have actually been reports of other markets where they've released additional spectrum to the, you know, to the resident telcos for the purpose of enabling, you know, communication because of this stress. So that definitely interesting times. It'd be helpful to get your perspective on the sources of these threats.
Well, you know, obviously criminal groups have always been a serious issue. They've gotten more sophisticated. Some of them have learned to exploit the internet to make literally millions of dollars in a single day. And there are an awful lot of tools and capabilities for committing cyber attacks that are available in a marketplace. You know, a big part of the internet is what we call the dark web. It's not accessible through your normal search engines. Often the sites there are password protected, but when you know where to go and you have the right password, you can buy all kinds of things, exploits to attack cyber networks. You can even buy drugs, child pornography, or even arrange for murders. So there's a whole subterranean part of the internet that is fostering and being fostered by criminal activity.
Got it. Thanks. So maybe let's pivot a little bit to advice you can offer to maybe starting with individuals who want to make sure that they're protected from these threats. And maybe to set this up a little bit, you know, some recent statistics that I read in the Symantec 2019 Internet Security Threat Report, you know, just to demonstrate how pervasive these attacks are. You know, you've got, for instance, 1 in 13 web requests that lead to malware. You have something like 1 to 36, 1 in 36 mobile devices have high risk apps, you know, installed on them unwittingly. You have a proliferation of IoT devices that are experiencing an average of 5,000 plus attacks per month, again, according to this study. How do these stats sort of align with the research you've done and just the trends you're seeing generally from an individual perspective and the devices we rely on?
I mean, I have to say, this is consistent with what I've seen and observed over the years. And let me begin by saying, you know, we recognize that individuals, particularly in their homes, have some limits on their ability to protect themselves. And a sophisticated actor can do a lot of damage to a single individual or someone who's working out of your home. But part of what we try to do is manage the risk, reduce the risk. Because if you make it too easy, then the criminals can act by scaling up what their activities are. So let me raise kind of four issues I think one ought to think about as an individual or a family. One is make sure the devices you have a reasonable amount of security and that you update them and patch them when a notice comes out from your software vendor that there's a problem and you need to remedy it. So update and patch. When you buy a, quote, smart device to connect to your network, make sure it has some basic security, like a password that you can put in yourself, that it has the ability to be patched and updated. Otherwise, you create a vulnerability. So that's the first.
Maybe to expound on this, the smart device thing, because I think, you know, the IoT in particular is really starting to emerge as a critical space on this front. Just defining what those devices include. I mean, you're talking about smart appliances, right? You're obviously talking about smartphones. You're talking about televisions, and
I'm talking
even
about,
our
I'm
cars
about
are.
Yeah, I'm talking about thermostats. Exactly. It could be video cameras in your home, and many of these are very simple devices with very little security. But I know of a case, for example, almost 10 years ago, where a major institution, private institution in Washington, was hacked through a thermostat in a remote building. So some of these things, which seem, you know, pretty harmless, actually can become the entry point into your network and result in real damage to, you know, vital data that you actually have in your computer network, including if you're working remotely at an office, it can then move into the office and affect the business. So these so-called smart devices, unless they are built with reasonable basic security, can become a real gap in your protection.
That's right. And just to build on that again, it sounds like the features do exist. It's just that, you know, often we don't activate them the way we should, right? Most of these devices do come with
correct.
Capability. Okay. Got it. All right. So
I'd say,
getting back to
let me amend that. I'd say some come with the ability to update and patch. To be honest, some of them have been put to market with no ability to update or patch. And I think one of the issues that people are looking at in the EU and in the US is whether there ought to be legal requirements that manufacturers put a certain amount of basic security in.
Right. All right, great.
So going back
to other
areas. So a second area, I think, again, if you're just as an individual trying to protect yourself, is what we call phishing. Somebody tricking you into turning over your password or your credentials so they can then use it to access your network whenever they please. This is the most basic kind of fraud, but it's an online version of it, because what they're trying to do is get the keys to your network, have you turn them over voluntarily, and then they can use it to enter at will. Usually this is accomplished by tricking you into clicking on a link or going to a website that you believe is legitimate, but actually is not. It's constructed in a way to look as if it is a real website or a real link from somebody that you know, and you click on it thinking that it's your friend is sending you something or your business partner. And when you do, you've downloaded malicious tools, which then can be used to exploit your network by the bad guys. How do you protect yourself against that? Well, one thing is you don't click on things simply because it looks like it comes from someone that you know. Sometimes you can tell by actually hovering over the address of the sender that the address is not legitimate. But sometimes it looks legitimate. And that's why I caution people not to click on links coming in email unless they have some independent confirmation, either by a text or some prior arrangement, to expect that this is actually something from someone that you know that's legitimate. This is really largely a matter of training, and you have to get people to recognize how tempting it is sometimes to click thoughtlessly and to resist the temptation until they've confirmed that is legitimate. So I know we do exercises at the companies I work with where we'll send something out that looks legitimate and we want to see how many people will click on it. And then they get a message saying, aha, we got you. You shouldn't have clicked on it. The right answer is if it comes from someone that you know and it looks important, you should reach out in some independent way and verify that it's legitimate. The third area that we see that's often exploited, again, in the case of individual networks, are weak passwords or unencrypted data. So if you, as some people do, have a password that's like 1234, it's pretty easy for bad guys to figure that out. And then once they have your password, they have your keys, and they go into your network. Even if they're in the network, if the data is encrypted, they can't do much with it. But if it's not encrypted, then they can steal it or alter it if they want. So the lessons here are to have a strong password, and that typically means one that has letters, symbols, and numbers, to encrypt the data in your network when you have it at rest or when you send it, and that you have a system in place for, in some cases, dual authentication, where to get into your network, it's not only your password, but it may be a fingerprint or it may be facial recognition. These kinds of tools give you extra measures of protection against somebody figuring out how they can get into your system without your knowing about it.
That's very helpful. So maybe turning to companies and companies, for instance, that don't have state-of-the-art IT departments. And here again, a few helpful statistics, just to put things in context. I think Symantec reported that 48% in their recent 2019 study, 48% of malicious emails, email attachments rather, are Office files. So, half of the activity that we're seeing in these attacks, because the value of information there. The average life cycle of a breach is 314 days from breach to actually containing that threat, right? So, you got a year period there where your systems are compromised and the level of impact could be devastating. And the average cost of time for a malware attack is 50 plus days. So, huge potential for disruption to any companies. Businesses, and we've certainly seen it play out with some degree of frequency over the past couple of years. What would you say are the sort of leading points to keep in mind from a company perspective?
Well, first of all the things I said about individuals apply to companies as well. Be careful about updating, be careful about making sure people have strong passwords, use encryption, and train your employees about phishing. But beyond that, you have to stand back and look at what is on your network and what's your nature of your business. There's a vast difference between, for example, the way a retail establishment uses the network and the way a power plant does. A retail establishment has to have an architecture that allows people to get online to shop and conduct business. A power plant doesn't have to have that. But a power plant has to worry that if somebody gets into the industrial control system, they can shut the lights out. So what that tells you is within every network, it's not just the endpoint or the perimeter that matters, but it's the way the network itself is configured and architected. And what you want to do is you want to identify the key elements that you're most nervous about that would be the most significant if they were compromised, and give them an extra measure of protection. So again, for a retail establishment, you might have a certain segment of the network that's available to the public, but you'd want to segment that and separate it from the business planning and financial element of the business, where you don't want to have a lot of people have access to that. And then once you've segmented the data, you create barriers between the segments, so that for the most sensitive data, you have to have extra special identification requirements and also limits on who has the right to access the data. So the identity and access controls mean that something that may be available to the public shopping for a catalog will not be available to the public if it has to do with financial record keeping of the business. It's a little bit like if you've ever been on a ship at sea, there are compartments that are watertight so that if there's a breach in the hull, you can close off the rest of the ship and it doesn't sink. So that whole element of ID and access controls is critical. Second, you've got to get your workforce educated to resist the kinds of tricks I mentioned earlier about phishing and things of that sort. And so running regular exercises and educating people on a regular basis is not that complicated, but it's very important because often people are the weakest link. The third thing, which I think you said, Bob, which is very important to remember is this. Almost every enterprise is going to get breached from time to time. The question is, what happens when you have been breached? And that's where part of the answer is segmentation. So a breach of one part of the network doesn't open the door to everything. But the second part is detecting the breach quickly. A breach that occurs that lasts for 5 days is much less likely to be a problem than one that lasts, as you point out, for almost a year. And Right. Typically the life cycle of a breach is there's initial reconnaissance in the network. They try to steal as many credentials as they can, and then they sit and wait and they harvest the data they want or create the mischief they want over a period of time. So early detection is very important. In much the same way to use the analogy to the current pandemic, early detection of a virus, a pandemic virus, helps you mitigate the damage. So how do you detect the breach in cyberspace? Well, part of what you do is you use behavioral analytics. You have a system which you can get from, you know, various vendors that is online that monitors for anomalous or unusual behavior, the timing of certain activities, whether a particular identity seems to be doing things or accessing things that don't make any sense, a change in the volume of data that's being moved and the timing. Those are keys that something is going on that you need to take a look at. So I think these are some of the things you can do if you're gonna try to keep your network as secure as possible and mitigate the damage.
Yeah, no, those are very helpful strategies and tactics. And I would probably add to that, that above and beyond sort of the systems, getting them configured properly, and even in the case where, you know, a lot of these workloads are now moving to reputable and reliable cloud platform companies, there are a lot of resources available to help companies actually think through how to implement and ensure that these best practices are actually incorporated in their systems and overall infrastructure. And, you know, I suspect, and I've certainly seen this across the region of us as I've met with different companies that, you know, think that a strategy is in some respects to just avoid the whole thing altogether. But as you've made very clear, you know, if you have something as simple as email, which everybody has, you know, you're subject to these threats. So that doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And I think one thing that we do a fair amount of in our cybersecurity practice with a lot of our clients is helping them prepare for and respond to cyber attacks. You know, and our advice ranges from a simple analysis on a company's legal obligations after they've experienced a breach and all the way to assisting, you know, with crisis management. But, you know, Mr. Secretary, I'd love to get your perspective on some examples of how we've worked with, you know, companies and clients, both large and small, on the overarching strategies that lead to some of the tactics and best practices that you've shared. What are some examples that you can share, maybe two or three, that help, you know, provide a little more color and how that should play out?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, well, we work with a number of companies on their legal and compliance obligations with respect to cyber. What do they need to worry about from a liability standpoint as well as an operational standpoint? What are the expectations, generally speaking, that the board is held to in terms of making sure they're mindful about cyber? What is your response plan? Because a big part of the damage that can occur is a poor response, and the ability to have a detailed and adequate response plan is critically important. The second element we work with is risk management. Given the nature of their business, and I've described how different businesses have different concerns, are they focused with their risk management on the appropriate risks? If you are, for example, a company that's dealing with a lot of personal data, you worry a lot about the legal risks with that data being stolen, and then you're going to have some obligations to customers, which can be very substantial. I mean, some years back, Target, the retail store, was hit very hard when personal data of customers was stolen, and ultimately the CEO had to leave. On the other hand, a power plant has a different set of issues to be concerned about in terms of your obligations to keep the power going. So having a clear sense of what your risks are and what your obligations are is important. And finally, in mergers and acquisitions, a lot of intrusions occur around M&A deals, either where no one has done proper due diligence of the acquisition, and so you're buying basically something that's riddled with cyber problems, or even in connecting them up, no one has paid attention to making sure there are no gaps between the network you're bringing in and the network you already have. And so part of the merger and acquisition process, and again, the legal obligations around that mean considering this as an important part of what you vet before you go forward and close a deal. And I've seen that on a number of different sides. One other thing I would say is this. I think that the effect of the virus is going to be to move more commercial activity online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to create even more exposure in terms of customer data, in terms of economic effects. And as this scales up, the need to make sure you are dotting your I's and crossing your T's will become even more urgent.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And I think particularly on the risk management assessments, you know, and in context of trends in Africa with respect to data protection regulations, I mean, we're at a point now where you've got, you know, maybe eight or so countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have proper data protection regulations in place. Then you have an additional, 11 plus, where these regulations are under development, but will be implemented in the very near future. And then maybe another 11 or so, actually, I think more than 11, maybe closer to 20 that have pending regulations, data protection. And with that comes an obligation for data controllers to actually disclose breaches within very short periods. You know, so if you don't have a plan in place, and you can't really respond effectively to these things, it's you know, there's in addition to the challenge of having to manage this, there's massive reputational damage, there's massive financial, you know, significant penalties associated. So I think in frontier markets in particular, we're going to start to see the adoption of these very strict legal obligations being implemented that I think, you know, should give pause to business owners to really think these issues through carefully and have proper strategies, right? Governance and compliance controls in place.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And, you know, even in terms of the way you handle data, there are going to be increasing legal restrictions and obligations about what you can do with data that you rightfully have.
Right.
And that's true partly because, for example, if you look at Europe has very aggressive data protection regulations, which they consider to be applicable to any European whose data is being held anywhere in the world. So if you're doing business, let's say you're banking, and you're banking with a global bank, you've got to be mindful about the cybersecurity issues around the globe and about the data protection issues around the globe. And one of the things we've worked with clients on is making sure they're not inadvertently creating a problem for themselves because they've missed a legal obligation somewhere.
That's exactly it. So in other words, again, I mean, I think that's a critical point to emphasize, you know, is it's given these are tech platforms that are cross-border in nature, you have an obligation in every market in which you offer your services, right? And these data breaches are exactly your point. They're global. And geez, now you've got, you know, hundreds of countries that you've got to think through and get ahead of and reporting obligations. And by the way, reporting obligations to both government as well as the owner of the data, right? And the data subjects, et cetera. So it's a fairly complex process, but to put these tactics in place requires a coherent strategy so that when those moments come, you're actually prepared and can sort of take a systematic approach to getting ahead of the issues and mitigating further threat to your infrastructure and certainly your customer base. So maybe turning to the policy issues a little bit, I'd love to get your view, because as you know, I spend most of my time talking to policymakers about the aspiration of sort of creating a vibrant digital market across the African continent and try to unpack, you know, what does that mean from a public policy perspective? What does it mean, you know, in terms of regulations that are potentially going to be adopted? And one thing that I keep hearing about is this notion that data is the new oil or gold. And I certainly can appreciate, you know, the analogy, because data is without question the you know, a critically, or it's a super valuable, not necessarily an asset, I guess it depends, but it's extremely valuable and more so than sort of natural resources. But given their this perspective, you know, policymakers are inclined to keep as much of that treasure on their shores, on within their borders. But at the same time, we live in an increasingly digital world fueled by services which depend entirely on cross-border data flows. So as you engage global leaders on these issues, what are you seeing with respect to, you know, the ability to strike the right balance between, you know, these national security considerations, which you've been at the heart of, obviously, in your previous role as the Secretary of Homeland Security, protecting the, you know, privacy of citizens and managing this onslaught of threats in a way that does not create barriers and add unnecessary friction to, you know, fostering economic and social prosperity, particularly in emerging and frontier markets. What are you seeing and what sort of discussions are you part of on this front?
So as you know, Bob, I wrote a book about this called Exploding Data. And what I would say is that there is a sometimes there's an instinct to try to hold or hoard data, but that actually defeats the purpose of having the internet. What you want to do actually, particularly if you're trying to build a vibrant commercial sector in your country, is you want to be engaged globally. That's something that's important for exports, it's important for imports, it's important for finance. There are a whole lot of things that are critical if you're going to grow as a global business or a global enterprise, and you can't do that if you hoard the data. Now, we understand there are certain elements of data you do have to protect. So your national security information, your intelligence information, obviously, you want to make sure that's held very closely. But I think in general, if you disconnect yourself from the internet, you create barriers, it's very short-sighted, particularly if you're dealing in the scale of a single country. Now, the Chinese have done a certain amount of localization, but they're a very large territory. And even there, they have suffered to some extent economically, because they are trying to create barriers with the flow of data. But for their reasons of their own governance, they want to make that sacrifice. I would say in Africa, though, certainly you want to have regional free flow. But beyond that, I'd say Africa has real opportunities, both in terms of attracting investment and being a market, that only work if you have connectivity with the rest of the world. A great example of that is India. Look how much of the service sector in India is online, doing work in the US, in Europe, IT support, all kinds of things. And that only works because India is connected to the internet. Now, that doesn't mean you don't protect the data, and there are ways to do it with encryption and similar things which I've talked about earlier. But it means that localization or cutting yourself off is as damaging as, for example, saying you're going to cut yourself off from global trade. It's in the long run going to hurt the development of your local and national economy.
And I would actually imagine that some of these issues with respect to data localization are actually being challenged in context of this very, you know, pandemic. Right? Because if you've got to coordinate the movement of people, you've got to coordinate the movement of supplies, you know, and if you have a fairly rigid framework, it does make that a bit more difficult. Or I'd certainly be interested in hearing more about how that plays out, and we'll probably, you know, have more discussions about it after the fact, but totally agree. Okay. So maybe turning back, you know, turning back to the pandemic and how we potentially see ourselves coming out of this environment, you wrote a very interesting piece in USA Today recently about, you know, how we dial back the coronavirus red alert. And as someone that's obviously managed high risk and high threat events, you know, it'd be interesting to get your perspective on an appropriate de-escalation to sort of this global viral pandemic that, you know, what should that potentially or will that look like?
Well, Bob, as you observed, this is a very challenging problem because my experience when we were dealing with terrorism or planning for pandemics, was it's a temptation sometimes to keep the alert read as long as possible because there's a feeling that, well, you won't be criticized because you're warning everybody all the time. But there are some very serious side effects to that. And as we see now, globally, can have real effect on the economy. That also affects people's health and affects people's morale and psychology. So you have to balance the way you keep people at high alert, but also recognize at some point you want to be able to relieve at least some of the pressure. So I begin by saying your response has to be based on science and facts. And I think everybody who's an expert in this area has said only with testing and the ability to monitor the flow of infection can you begin to decide when it might be possible to lift the restraints a little bit. And in general, what they're saying, given the incubation period, is you probably need to see a decrease in the incidence of people getting infected over a two-week period before you can begin to believe that the pandemic is beginning to kind of peter out. And that's made more challenging by the fact that we're not really sure how immunized people are if they've recovered from the virus. And there needs to be some more scientific work on that. Once we see that it looks as if the pandemic is decreasing in terms of the infection rate, and that we are able now to manage the infections in our healthcare system, then you might begin loosening up slowly. So, for example, you might allow certain establishments to reopen as long as they practice social distancing, they don't have too many people crowded in one place, they take sanitary steps to make sure that people aren't easily infected. And I think that's something which needs to be done in stages. Some things like, for example, big celebrations or big concerts are probably going to have to wait quite a while because you're bringing a lot of people together in a small and confined space. So right. As we did in the U.S., you want to have two or three levels of dialing down the restrictions. And if at some point it looks as if the degree of contamination is beginning to increase again, you have to revert back to a stricter set of rules. And that makes the final point. Without the ability to monitor infection rates and how contained and mitigated the virus is, it's very hard to make an intelligent decision, which is why getting these tests out there and having them be available and be able to be resolved quickly is a very, very high priority in managing this crisis.
Well, those are great insights, and thank you so much. Maybe as we conclude, let me try to take a stab at a quick summary of the points that we've covered, and I would invite you to, you know, expound on any of these points if you think it doesn't adequately, you haven't really captured it well. So with respect to just best practices for individuals, you know, obviously we're all stuck in, you know, at home and working from home with all these devices. You know, I think the takeaway point there really is be aware, right? I mean, you've got these devices and their security issues potentially there. You've got this onslaught of phishing emails, et cetera, weak passwords, but be mindful and be aware. Is that a fair way to capture that first, you know, set of guidance to individuals?
Absolutely. Without awareness and without being mindful, nothing you put on your network or buy is going to protect you.
Great, great. And then I think with respect to companies that are grappling with these issues, I think the takeaway point really is have a plan, right? We've talked about the importance of governance and compliance plans and strategies that companies can develop in order sort of as a preparedness and response measure. We've talked about taking a risk-based approach as opposed to a threat-based approach, because ultimately, you know, there's massive value to be unlocked in using technology. And we don't want, you know, to create an overly rigid system that, you know, undermines the ability of people to build successful businesses and certainly add value to society generally. Anything you would add to that point?
That's exactly right. And you know, the key to being risk managed is to assess carefully with the nature of your business, what are the most valuable assets, what are the things which, if compromised, would be devastating? And then how do you give those the maximum protection without necessarily undercutting or hampering the fact that you still need to do business and you may need to have some outward-facing connectivity with customers and clients?
Excellent. Great. And then I think maybe the last point with respect to just particularly, I think, in some respects, unique to emerging and frontier markets is just taking a global perspective in developing policies and regulations, because ultimately we are transitioning into a services-driven world. And, you know, having local internets isn't particularly, you know, that may not be a scalable strategy with respect to, you know, attracting foreign direct investment, creating a robust and vibrant tech-driven ecosystem, and certainly creating local opportunities. Any last points you'd like to add to that one?
I would say, I think, you know, we see now for a lot of people in Africa and similar markets, you know, banking is even more online than it is in some of the countries of Europe and the U.S. And that means you have to have the ability to operate securely, but also in a global financial environment, because nobody can operate a financial system in total isolation. So, I mean, if we're going to say, I think Africa has tremendous promise. It's a great market. There's some great opportunities commercially for the continent. But to really get the benefit of those, Africa is going to have to be and stay connected in a secure way. And I know we're very happy to work with people on that.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, in our work, you know, I've worked with some just exceptional talents, and I think the upside is just enormous. So hopefully adopting these best practices and smart approach to mitigating and managing risk will certainly make the difference in the long and, well, certainly the short and long term. I think maybe the last point is I'd love to just suggest and recommend a helpful resource in addition to the points that we've covered is recommending the Center for Internet Studies. They have a set of 20 or so best practices that they've recommended that improve their cyber, you know, that companies can adopt and download for free to improve cyber defenses against sort of the best known threats. And we'll include that in a summary document that we'll attach to this audio file. But Secretary, thank you so much for your wonderful insights and certainly for your service to not just the U.S., but the global community on these critical issues, and very much looking forward to staying connected and unpacking this further over time. So thanks again.
I am as well, and I wish you and everybody who's listening to this that they stay well, that they stay safe, and when we come out the other side, we come out more robust and more energetic and better prepared for the future.
Indeed. Thank you very much, and stay safe, everyone. Thank you.